This is the beginning of a series of discussions. The topic for this particular beginning is the necessity for the use of Huna. Huna, as we know, is the old word for secret. It comes from the Polynesian dialect spoken by the Hawaiians. And the keeper of the secret was called a kahuna. From the ancient records that we have stowed in the legends and in the roots of the words, we have derived a knowledge of the ancient system. We find that it contains all that we know today of modern psychology, including a knowledge of the subconscious mind or low self, the conscious mind or middle self, and a superconscious or high self part of mind, of which science has not yet definite information. The complex is also something that the kahunas many, many, many centuries ago knew about and worked with to eliminate. In addition, there was the part of Huna which included the knowledge of man dead as well as alive, and the knowledge of spirits of various kinds, not inhabiting a solid physical body, but inhabiting bodies made of shadowy Akka substance. The question is asked sometimes, why should one bother with a system as ancient as this and one which was developed by a savage people? The answer to that is that the civilization which developed Huna, it is a civilization perhaps 50,000 years old, we have no way of knowing, possibly Atlantean in its origin, gives evidence of having attained in psychology and religion, those two points, and if you wish to say psychic science, a knowledge which we moderns still have not caught up with. The search for a perfect knowledge of ourselves and of our relation to invisible powers has been going on for many centuries. We have it in all of the standard religions. So the question, then, of why we should pay attention to Huna comes down to a simple proposition. Do we wish the ultimate truth on these matters, or do we wish half-truths? Of course, we all wish to have the ultimate, the final truth, if we can get it, and Huna is the nearest to that which has yet been discovered. It contradicts many of the dogmas of modern religions, but on the other hand, no two religions agree. All contradict the dogmas of the others. So we have in Huna a basic thing that appears in all of the ancient religions and shows that at one time contact was had with the migrating or traveling kahunas when they came down through Egypt, went down through Madagascar on the African side, when they went down through Arabia, down through India, down through Sumatra and Java, up through Japan, and finally out into the islands of the Pacific. They left their words behind them, and they left their ideas. It was evident that they stopped long enough in their journeying here and there to initiate the priests of other religions. As a result of this, when the initiation was not passed on longer, the knowledge was lost and contorted. For instance, we have in India a very contorted idea of the vital force or mana that the Polynesians still know and still have words for in the language, and which was vital in the secret lore of Huna. In India, that became prana. And instead of being one grade of this force, but changed to serve three purposes to fit the needs of the low, the middle, and the high selves. This prana was stretched out and made into many, many pranas, one for smelling with, one for seeing, one for hearing, one for this and that and the other, until there were something like about 49 to 50 of them. Later on, in the old tantric yoga, there were little tubes postulated for the mana to flow down, and the tubes had to flow and the mana had to move as prana for something like 72,000 different branches of the nadis or tubes, and each had its own type of prana to go along. So you can see how the dogmas and the misconceptions grew. An idea of how a misconception grew in Christianity may be worth working with this time. At one place, and one place only, in the New Testament, do we find a quotation accredited to Jesus saying, "I and the Father are one." That is in John. It is a separate verse. And none of the other writings, Luke or Matthew or Mark, have anything that matches this. But in spite of that fact, that something as greatly important as that would not have been overlooked by the other disciples in their writings, it was seized upon by early church and made into a vast dogma in which Jesus is God. God is Jesus. And it followed that as Jesus was God, his mother Mary was the mother of God. And on the radio programs, night after night, you can turn on the Rosary Hour and hear them chant, "Mary, Mother of God." Well, it's a little bit silly to a person who stops to argue out the size of God as the maker of Betelgeuse and all of the universe filled with stars, that one human mother could mother God. But perhaps the words mean less than they say. We will hope so anyway. The original Huna is singularly free from these flights of imagination, from these strange and illogical things. It is as near a science as we have come in our study of psychology. Of course, psychology cannot be put into a test tube and therefore will never be a physical science. It will have to be classified as a mental science in its final stages, when we arrive at the place where we will accept anything mental as possible as a scientific basis of research. Now, to get back to the original question, why should we accept Huna or any other religion and try to put it to use in our own lives? The answer to that is one that has been bandied about from religion to religion over the centuries. In Christianity, we were taught that salvation from some form of hell or Hades was necessary because man had been born in sin. That is, the original sinful Adam, and through the sin, so-called, of the parents in producing the child. Therefore, man would automatically be lost, would be condemned to a Hades of sorts, unless he was able to get salvation. Salvation, so the dogma grew up, came through a belief that Jesus was the Son of God and was God, as we have said in that dogma. In order to become saved, there was one great necessity. That was to believe on the name of the Lord. As a side issue on that, a person needed to confess his sins and to turn over a new leaf. But there was still the 11th hour or deathbed confession of sin to be made. And although the Catholics added the idea of purgatory to give some punishment, nevertheless, there was salvation at the last minute, with or without works of any notable kind. On the other hand, in India, the religions that developed from the original Vedic lore. The Vedas were stories which were told by their religious and more or less of the parable nature, story of the gods. And because of their great antiquity, they were accepted in India as the Jews accepted the Old Testament as the Word of God. The entire tangle in the Hindu religion on that revolved around the idea that all life, all living, all life experience was painful and was not worthwhile. It was painful because it was not eternal and lasting. Anything that did not last was not a pleasure, but became a pain. It was a very poor piece of logic, but they had borrowed the idea in the early days when Huna was being lost after it had once been introduced. And in the works of Kapila, we read that now is the time to examine the ways of escaping from pain, that is, escaping from ordinary living with its joys and its sorrows. Later on, when Buddha attempted to reform the old religion of the Bhagavad Gita and the various systems of Kapila and things that had sprung up from the Vedas, he laid great stress on the fact that all living was very, very painful, that it could be nothing but pain, and therefore to escape in to the realm of nirvana, one must so live as to escape the whole of living. The whole thing was a little preposterous, but so was more or less all of the warped versions of Huna and religion as they have come down to us. We may ask now, what does the modern person hope to escape or to gain from the use of Huna as a combination of psychology, that is, knowing himself and knowing mankind, and of knowing the gods, or the higher beings, the high self in our case, as God is in the ultimate, too far beyond the grasp of the human imagination to be of much use to us in our task of living. We need to know that there is a God, that the life force flows through us, the intelligence flows through us that we say comes from God. But we need particularly to know about the high self, which is the higher part of ourselves and is the next step above us in its wisdom. Also, it has greater power. It can see into the future and into the past up to a certain extent and can guide us if we are willing to accept guidance. Today, we have no fear of hell to speak of. The idea of karma as something that goes over from one incarnation to another and which must be worn out by slow degrees, perhaps through a million incarnations, has been more or less tossed aside by the thinking people. Some of us still agree that karma is to blame for all of our mishaps, not ourselves, but that isn't a very helpful attitude toward life. In our own survey of the reasons to be good, to be hurtless, to be helpful, those things which are the basis of Huna and of religion in general, the reason that we should do these things is mostly social and ethical. From a social standpoint, if we are kind to each other, if we learn from the bees and the ants to work together cooperatively to accomplish something that one person alone cannot accomplish, then we are following nature. Nature has pointed us the way for cooperation instead of for the strong and warlike competition that we see all around us, in which the strong do away with the weak, and especially with the privileges of the weak. We see it in war, we see it in business, we see it in politics. The ideal, therefore, that all of us can understand and grasp, is to be good because it is socially correct to be good. To be good because it is ethically or morally correct to be good. Of course, for a great many people, that is not a sufficient reason. Now, the people who are naturally bad, and there are a number of people, as we see, they fill our penitentiaries, and we see them as a predatory individual in business, the cheats, the liars, the thieves, all of the ones who take unfair advantage in various ways. This type of person has to have some other incentive, and the naturally evil person is not yet able to see that he is better off when society is bettered by his cooperation and his kindness and his goodness. For that type of person, the threat of hell used to be a police force, the threat of retribution. In the kahuna circles for many, many, many centuries, they had a special kahuna who did a death prayer. He used disembodied spirits for that purpose as a rule, and the person who could not be punished by the ordinary justice of the land was punished by having the spirits sent to him to take his life force away from him until he was drained dry of mana and died. That process took about 3 days. There was also a traditional method of handling the death prayer, which was called the burning. The details of the way that was handled have never been cleared up. If it was an exact science with the kahunas, they left no evidence to show us just what happened. When they took something that belonged to the person who was to be killed, like a hair or a fingernail, made chants over it and burned it as part of the work without recourse to the help of spirits of the low self disembodied type. As our modern criminal has no fear of anything except the law has to be enforced by the police and by the public in general, by public opinion. But that doesn't help us when we come down to the people who are trying to help, who are naturally good. We wish to increase the goodness of the circle in which we live, of the society in which we live. And we turn to Huna now to ask, does that goodness bring us any other reward? That brings us to the old, old Huna theory, which seems to be the nearest correct of any theory that we have in any religion. It is similar to the Hindu religion, except that the Huna in the Hindu religion was warped and stretched away out of shape. Where the Hindus say there are as many incarnations to be lived as there are grains of sand by the side of the sea, and that all of the karmic retribution from all of those incarnations must be suffered out and erased through living out the retribution before one can go back to God. The kahunas thought that there were just a few incarnations. We started out, or we would say we could picture ourselves in the midst of an incarnation. It is a little like the question, who made the egg, or what came first, the egg or the chicken? So we find ourselves with a picture of a man having three selves. These can be compared to the first grade student, the second grade student, and the third grade student. All three are learning, all three are studying, and at the end of the season, the year, all three will graduate into the grade next higher. The low self is the animal self. He's the first grader, and he knows very little about school. His teacher is life, or nature, and he has an older brother, the middle self, whose job it is to teach him a great many things. It has to teach him to cease to be an animal living under the law of tooth and fang, and to begin to learn to cooperate like human beings should cooperate. As we have said, the example is set by the cooperating hives and the ants and the herds and the flocks all the way down through nature. where one thing helps another. The low self gradually learns by association and by being caused by the middle self through the use of its will to act like a human being, to react kindly and helpfully. After a while, when the low self has been properly trained and the middle self has also learned the lesson which it has to know of kindness and of love and of helpfulness, then graduation takes place. The high self, which has supervised the middle and the low self during this school year, but of whom we do not know very much, supposedly graduates to a super high self. The Hawaiians call that an akua, or god, aumakua, or parental para-spirits. They were father and mother combined. This amounts to evolution. The theory is that whenever we grow and evolve, we are like a child who grows and is very happy. It grows stronger every day, and it is in step with nature. If a child should refuse to grow, stay the same size, and go contrary to nature, it would become sick and would die. So in the same way, generally speaking, we have our theory of evolution given to us by Huna. We are taught that if we go with the stream of growth on toward learning, toward being more kindly, more reliable, more helpful, then very quickly the stream will carry us to graduation. And we go on to the next level of consciousness. The low self, in a new incarnation, then graduates and becomes the middle self. It takes from the animal kingdom a low self and begins its own work of teaching them. He is his brother's keeper. Then the middle self goes on into the level of the Aumakua, or the everlastingly trustworthy parental spirit pair, whose trademark is to be utterly trustworthy. That is, they violate none of the laws. We will speak of that a little bit later. We do not become high selves having charge over a pair of human beings at first. We have to serve an apprenticeship to become wise enough. We become the apprentices of the group souls. We look over a large group of crystals and see to it that they all form in exactly the right way. We overlook perhaps part of the vegetable kingdom, part of the insect world, part of the animal world. And only at last, when graduations have been going along a little bit, are we one day assigned to the charge, perhaps, of the low self that is now a middle self, and of the new animal self, which the other second grader has annexed when it had graduated to be a third grader. The whole thing then amounts to a matter of whether we are going to speed up our evolution, whether we are going to go with the stream and make the incarnations as short and as happy and as smoothly lived as possible, or whether we are going to swim against the stream, do all of the things that cause us to have setbacks, and to really begin to suffer, like the Hindus have pointed out, making life a great and everlasting business of suffering, all the retributions and things of that kind. In living this evolutionary life, in going quickly from one level to the next, we might examine the idea of karma that they have in the Hindu lore, but which in Huna is divided into three different types of karma. The first karma could be well illustrated by the man who eats too much. He goes out and has a very large dinner. He comes back and has the stomachache. He gets over that if there's just, say, one indulgence, and the next day or the day after, he's back in fine shape again. But he has suffered a small physical karma. The reaction is physical with him. On the other hand, if he becomes a glutton and eats too much every night of the world and is perhaps drinking too heavily at the same time, that leads to overweight and to a physical breakdown. In that, we have a physical karma. That is not a mental karma. On the other hand, the mental karma may be seen in the man who thinks wrong. All of new thought revolves around the idea of thinking wrong and therefore having your circumstances and your health go wrong. If a person thinks hurtful thoughts, if he wishes to cheat someone, if he wishes to make someone unhappy, if he wishes to bedevil his wife or to make things hot for his children, or if he is just hateful and envious and vindictive, the thoughts that he thinks, if they cannot find expression, if he is unable to go out and hurt somebody physically that he wishes to hurt and would like to hurt very much, it turns back on him in a strange way, and he suffers the mental karma. The psychosomatic illnesses, which we now know compose about 70% of all of our troubles, that is, it mixes in to be traceable in about 70%, mixing with the physical and taking advantage of the weak spots. Those psychosomatic ills are all caused by bad thinking. We know that part of the bad thinking is shared by the low self in its complexes. And another part of this bad thinking that belongs really to the middle self as a primary seat of trouble are the evil spirits which are attracted to us because we think evil and because we will tolerate their little insidious promptings to do evil things. In the New Testament and also in Genesis in the Old Testament, we find the Huna story repeated of the complex. That is, the ideas of the illogical nature which have been placed in the subconscious by accident or by other means. They really are the seeds of a mental karma. They cause trouble in the physical. We react badly. We have physical reactions that are not right. And one thing leads to another until perhaps we turn over one day and find that we're just on our last lap and we are still filled with hatred, still filled with resentment, and are still doing the mental things that we should not do. I talked the other day with Mr. Haggerty, who is using E-therapy. And I said, what has been your experience with cancer? And he said to me, in every case that I have studied, I have found that there is a deep-seated hatred that has been frustrated in the working out. He said, I am convinced that at least a great part of the cancerous afflictions of the world have been caused by this hatred, this resentment that has found no expression, but which has reacted on the physical body. I might add to that that there's a possibility we see in Huna that spirits attaching themselves to the physical body take over little sections and develop those cancerous conditions. You might say they obsess a part of the body and their greeds and their drive to grow and to produce a body that would give them a chance to function on this plane result in the awful conditions and tangles. That, of course, is the realm of speculation and theory. Later on, we may know more about that. The karma reaction the nature of it, of the high self, is a little hard to see. By the time you get to be a high self or graduate on that level, you have learned to be utterly trustworthy. So just what the high selves might do that would cause evil reaction on their level, it is hard to see, possibly nothing. But we know that there is the reaction that we could call karmic, for want of a better word, the law of cause and effect on the mental and on the physical plane. So those things must be taken into consideration when we set about using Huna, our knowledge of Huna, to live better, to evolve better. to go ahead faster. It would be wonderful if all of us could take the attitude that just to do right for right's sake is enough. We are idealistic, especially when we are young. We can grasp an idea of that kind, and we can say, yes, that's fine. I'm going to do right just because it is right. But for the majority of the low selves who have their word to say in our lives, their whole background as animal selves has been, you don't do anything unless it gets you some reward. The hen doesn't scratch if there's no worm to be had. Of course, the hen will scratch endlessly where there are no worms, but she is always hopeful. She's always eyeing the ground and always scratching. So most people react only if they are driven by hunger and have to act in such a way that they expect and do get food. The low self cannot be very well stimulated into action unless it has a hope of one or two things. It likes its enjoyment through the eye. It likes it through the ear. It likes it through the senses. Sports and traveling to see new places. Of seeing friendly people, of dancing, of learning new physical activities, skating, swimming, all of those new experiences which the young animal soul is gaining, those are all bribes to bribe the animal soul into all of the new activities. Hunger, of course, and the desire to reproduce the race, those things are great stimuli and cause the soul to act in the animal level. The mental self has for its stimulus all of the wonders of the mental world. We are like Ohajimera Toga in the old newspaper column. We ask to know. That is our great desire. We wish to know how to do things, when to do things, and we wish above all to know why we are made to do things in certain ways by nature, by forces. Huna gives us a very fine answer to the why of nature. We are forced to do things by nature in order to keep us going forward. In ending this short lecture on the tape, we may say that these ideals, these problems, these considerations which surround the matter of growth, the matter of using Huna, are things which we grow by degrees. We were talking on the other side of the tape about the benefits to be derived from using the ancient Huna system. We may review that for a minute. The old days, people thought that they might escape the hellfires and damnation by being good and be rewarded by going to heaven. In the Hindu circles, they thought they would escape and attain release from the great wheel of reincarnation, one following the other endlessly, and wear out their old karma so that they could finally simply lay down life and escape into the reabsorption with the Supreme. We said that our own Huna system that we were about to follow had the advantage for us of a complete psychology as well as a good religion. That we need not go into at this time, but the reward of good living is social well-being. That is the good of the group, and the main thing, the large, the important thing, is that we as individuals are able to evolve. We go with the stream of evolution. Down in Honolulu, I was teaching years ago And we had no way to teach the children who came in out of the plantations with no English at all to speak English as they were being taught in English. The result of that was that a plantation child would come into the schools where everyone spoke English, and it would take 3 or 4 years of listening, sitting around, and of learning English on the playground before that child could begin to learn. I had a father come to me, a Japanese father, and he had the priest with him, the Zen Buddhist priest, and the priest had looked in his dictionary, and so he translated and explained. And the father said to me, he said, "I want my boy to go into the fields and learn to hoe because he is very tired." And then the priest explained, "He has been in grade number one for 4 years, and his endurance can no longer stand enduring." So, if we look at it that way, how many years have we been first graders? In other words, are we standing still in our evolutionary progress? And can we learn the joy of going ahead? There's an old saying, nothing succeeds like success. And we have learned that nothing gives us greater joy than to be able to make our projects work. We make our garden and it blooms. That's grand. We plan this and we plan that. And frustration brings pain if it doesn't work. But when it does work, that is a pleasure. We, perhaps if we are composers, compose beautiful music. And if it succeeds, that's fine. We write the great novel. We write the fine story. We write the play. We do the things that are creative. So all progression offers us the joy of going ahead instead of having to go back over the first grade time after time after time. I have always thought that when I see someone very, very bored, I am looking at a person whose progression has stopped. If they are going ahead, if they have interest in life and everything is all booming, then I feel that they must be progressing in one direction or not. Sometimes they're progressing hurtfully, but nevertheless, they are doing something. They are getting places. The jumping-off spot for a HUNA group, a group which undertakes under their own selected leadership and with HUNA before them, to attempt to make a progress, to evolve, to have the joy of growth and of evolution and of service, the joy of the Lord, if you please, needs a starting point. The trouble with most of us when we start out to get all of those things is that we do not know how far along we are. The Hindus call that how far along the path. The path is a typical HUNA symbol, but with the kahunas, it meant the akakord leading to the high self. However, we may say the path through life, through the three grades of life. Fortunately, we have a method by which we can ascertain more or less our standing to know whether we are about to graduate from the first grade into the second or the third or whatnot. This is the biometric method. That's a rather interesting story. Some of you may know it and some may not. The pendulum was at first used for water dowsing and things of that kind. The subconscious swings the pendulum if we give the subconscious or the low self orders to tell us through the swinging of the pendulum, certain facts that it can instinctively learn or that it can pick up with its finer sensory organs that are located in the shadowy body. It can sense the radiation of water. Therefore, we can use a pendulum or a willow stick and can do dowsing for water. Over in France, where they pioneered testing the various food products to see whether they were good or bad, with the use of the pendulum swung over the food particles, there was a Frenchman by the name of Bovis who developed a little bit more complicated system. He decided that there was a radiation from all objects. He would take an egg or a seed, a melon, a cheese, a cask of wine, or a person, and would measure the rate of radiation with his pendulum. His idea was that all radiations were in terms of the speed of light and perhaps the strength of light in some degree. In any event, he worked out a scale of degrees, which are about, each degree is a little more than 2 centimeters. 100 of those degrees would add up to about 17 inches in our English measure. He found that a perfectly healthy human body would make the pendulum swing crosswise to a line drawn from the body to the pendulum. You can imagine that. Here's the body. The man, of course, he used a sample, a blood spot. Then draw a line straight out, and on that line, you bring the pendulum back and forth, until you find a place where the pendulum will swing at exactly right angles to the line, make a T-swing across it. And that point where it swings like a T across this imaginary or a real line, he had a real line, he laid a tape measure down there marked off in what he called degrees biometric. And he would ascertain by the degrees biometric whether the person was healthy or not. 100 degrees biometric was perfect health. 80 degrees was not so good. 50 degrees was a sick man, and of course a dead man was no degrees at all. He registered zero. Mr. Bovis, or Monsieur Bovis, did a beautiful job developing the Bovis biometer. He was very successful with it. He for years held down a job as inspector of cheeses and wine casks and things for the French government. He could tell with his pendulum and his biometer whether the cheese was good and whether the wine was good. He could start things very, very rapidly, and they no longer had to take a plug in the cheese or open the cask of wine to take a sample. A little later, I don't know how old Bovis was at the time, Dr. Brundtler arrived on the scene. His father was a Norwegian or a Swedish nobleman, I'm not quite sure which. His mother was a French woman from a family of pottery makers. He had an opportunity for an excellent education, got caught in the First World War behind the German lines, had a great deal of trouble, finally escaped and finished his work as I think he finished by going back to school in England. Anyway, he had a very excellent scientific education, and one of the things which was very unscientific that interested him was the Bovis biometer. To make a long story short, he found that the biometer not only would measure physical things, such as the cheese and the health of the liver, it also would measure the characteristics of a person. It would measure the will of the middle self. It would measure the natural goodness or badness, the tendency, and the power of the urge or drive of the low self. The first of these things it measured by giving a straight back and forth swing of the pendulum on the biometer. The biometer is a long measuring device. You can measure it out, that is, have a ruler made of metal, or you can have it made of paper with the degrees marked out. The main thing is that it uses the old Bovis system of 100 centimeters, giving about 50 degrees Bovis. Not quite that, but around that. The Bovis biometer scale was enlarged by Dr. Brundtler because he needed to measure things that had a radiation rate longer than the 100 degrees. So he lengthened it out to 1,000 degrees and experimented, finding that the human will would measure at any space. The will and the personality could be measured at 1 degree or at 1,000 degrees. That seemed to make no difference. But the radiation then of the intellect, what he called the radiation of the soul, the measure of the brain radiation, the combination perhaps of the middle self, the lower self, and whatever high self unit there might be working to make the man's intellect, that was measured in terms of distance. How many degrees bovis, or degrees biometric as we now call it, stood between the pendulum where it was swinging and the sample. This sample, the blood spot, the saliva spot, the signature written with ink could be used. Also, signatures on old paintings would give the reaction of the person long dead. A person also can put the tip of the right thumb, not the ball, but the very tip of the right thumb on the scale and move it back and forth. And when the place is just right, the right distance between the tip of the thumb and the pendulum that is swinging across the end of the scale, that indicates in degrees biometric what the sum total of the intellect is. Now, with an instrument of that kind, which is not too hard for a person of fairly good ability with a pendulum to learn to use, we can find out where we stand. We can find out whether we have a good personality pattern, a good will pattern, and about how intelligent we are in terms of the biometer. The moron, Dr. Brunner found, started in at about 218 degrees biometric. After that, they became a little bit smarter, and the average person in the less progressive countries, in India and Africa and places like that, he found they averaged about 240 degrees biometric. In America and England and Europe, the average was 10 degrees higher, about 250. That would include around 95 people out of 100 that would run around the 250 level or below or slightly above it. Out of the other very few people, here and there one goes up so that he's at a level around 300. And the rare people going up 350, 375, 380, and up to 400, then they become very, very rare indeed. Some of the executives, the great generals, the people who have the longest vision and the greatest intelligence run along from 400 to 500. The great composers and the great artists, especially the artists, run up into the 600s. And Leonardo da Vinci, who was the wisest man that Dr. Brunner ever was able to find, measuring by signatures on paintings and from old writings, ran around 725. Dr. Brunner said that his own radiation was higher than that, and that he was anxious to find someone in the flesh who had a similar radiation so he could learn from them what their characteristics were. He knew what his own characteristics were, he said, but he needed more people to compare, but he had only found one other than himself, and that was Da Vinci, who had died a long time back. Be that as it may, most of us are not up in the high scales. I'm not sure that we are all going to have to get to those very high levels before we graduate into the next grade above. In testing the signatures of some of the great teachers of India, some of the men who have attained a very high spiritual stature, we find that they run surprisingly low. Dr. Brunner found that, and I have tested some of the pictures of different ones, like Sri Ramakrishna, and found that they ran under the 353 mark, which surprised me. I thought that they should really run away, way up high. But what we may guess from this is that it takes not a high intelligence, but a high goodness in order to be able to progress. Also, a fairly firm will development. So, as we look at the problem, we say, if I stand at, say, around 350, and I wish to increase my pardon my standing, by conscious effort, I go ahead then with my biometric testing. I find out whether my pattern is as good as it can be, and I take steps to better it. Concentration on things, meditation, holding the mind on one point, develops the willpower. The hypnotist, who is practicing every day, concentrating to drive with great determination a series of thoughts, that is, he's giving suggestion to his patients, into the mind of the patient, develops a great concentration. His will pattern usually is straight up and down, the perfect will pattern, running over the T mark on the biometer. We have what we call a lozenger on the biometer. It's a metal plate that sits at the end of the long ruler. And this has a straight up and down line running from the operator away from him and back to him. If the pendulum follows that line directly back and forth, then that is the perfect will pattern. Most of us in the occult work, as we call it, have a leaning will. It swings off diagonally to the right. If it swings off diagonally to the left, it indicates the tendency to use the will for bad things instead of for good. To the right, which we call the clockwise, because we measure things with a clockwise circle in the pattern for the personality next, that is a good will pattern. The pattern of the personality shows immediately on the biometer over the plate after the will has been registered by the pendulum. And that should be a circle. The hypnotists, many of them, have nothing but will. Their personality and their low selves have been so downtrodden and browbeaten and forced into line that they hardly have a bit of expression. I've measured several hypnotists who had a perfect will pattern, but almost nothing in the way of a personality pattern. And unfortunately, quite a number of them had a counterclockwise swing of the personality pattern, indicating that their powerful will was not being used for good things, but rather for bad or for imposition on people. At least that would indicate that their intentions had the counterclockwise or bad leaning. If a person has a perfect circle going to the right and it is quite large and strong, then we say that person has a low self that is quite well advanced. It has been trained over several incarnations to act like a human being instead of like a savage animal. That is a great heritage, a great blessing to bring over from a few incarnations back. If, on the other hand, a person has a personality circle that goes counterclockwise, then we still have with us the animal low self. Either it has not been trained very much, either it's a young soul, not many incarnations along, still has not learned to be a kindly human being instead of to react as a rather savage animal, and very much in need of being trained. So, if a person finds themselves with a bad personality pattern and a fair will pattern, they can take themselves in hand and, by daily exercises, can teach the low self to be human. That is, to be good, to be cooperative, to be helpful. One of the ways a person can do that is to watch their reactions. So many people sitting on their front porch watching a stranger go past will glare at that, and who's that in our neighborhood? What are they doing? What do they want? And so on. It's an antagonistic attitude. Like a dog growls at all strange dogs as they come past and threatens to bite them. That attitude of mind is a typical, untrained, low-self attitude. And just as an example, if we take to blessing everyone going past, we bless the stranger, the lame, the halt, the blind, and say, God bless you, and may your life be good. And if we have an opportunity, go out and help them change the tire if their car is stuck, or do some little thing. Action impresses the subconscious the low self very much more than just thought. If you can do one little thing for someone to help them out, that impresses the low self. And strangely enough, the low self, even if it has been on the dog-eat-dog side, responds with a thrill of pleasure and pride when it has been taught the lesson of the moment of helping someone. Perhaps the greatest pleasure that mankind knows is that that comes from turning to go with the stream instead of against it and helping someone. We feel a strange glow that is not logical, but it's emotional. And the low self seems to know instinctively that it is going in the right direction. On the other hand, if we quarrel with somebody, if we take advantage of somebody, if we do some little dirty trick, then we say our conscience hurts us. Now, whether conscience comes from the high self or not is a moot point. It's hard to say, but it may be that the prompting of the high self is the conscience. But almost everyone who has even the slightest progression to their credit through their first grade will have a knowledge of right and wrong. And the person who does a bad deed has a twinge of conscience to tell him that was wrong. He has pity sometimes for the person that he's hurt after he has hurt them. On the other hand, if he does a good deed for someone, or he does something that he knows he should do himself, that is, he gives a push away from the table when he's eaten enough, then he feels proud of himself. He feels, I am a good person. I have done something good. That is very fine. So we have the beginning of the tastes of the joy of the Lord. And as service continues, and as we go into the work of helping the social progression of our group, our friends, our city, our world, then we have the joy. With our work, we're a great deal like Will Levington Comfort said we should be. He said, before you can begin to teach and can set yourself up as a teacher, you should first take yourself in hand and learn to do the things that you would tell others to do. That is rather important for those of us who are trying to present HUNA to the world. That is a great service. That is a great social thing. In all the mass and tangle of religions and psychologies, here we have the beautiful, clear, logical, and simple HUNA system, and the world needs it now as it has never needed a religion, perhaps in untold centuries. We are ready for it now. We are a literal people. And we stand on the verge of jumping into the stream and being washed away, going entirely off the course with our atom bombs and hydrogen bombs and our wars and the great social upheaval of the time. Our service, then, begins with missionary work for HUNA, in which, while we talk about it with others, while we help others to understand it, we take regular and measured steps to change our own personality patterns for the better, to increase our will better, and, if possible, to raise our brain radiation. In the HUNA Research Associates activities and tests, we carried on a two-month test on the part of the different ones who each selected his own method of growth. Some did meditation, some did affirmations, some did works, good works, some prayed. We all had our own ideas, and they were all tested more or less over a period of 2 months of intensive work to see if the signature, which I had been reading on the biometer before and in the middle of the period and at the end of it, would show progression. Dr. Brunner said that the greatest advance that he had ever found in a single lifetime in the brain radiation was 6 degrees biometric, and that was a man who had suffered a great deal And he thought perhaps that the Hindus were right, that life was painful, and that the more you suffered, the more karma you worked out, and the more you evolved. I question that very much, because several of the people in the HRA in 2 months' time, with no suffering and with increased pleasure in their own accomplishments, were able to increase their biometric degree reading. Another thing that is of interest while we're on that topic of testing, and that is this. A person can go up and then they can backslide and come down again. There was one instance of a gentleman who made a very intense effort to use Dianetics. He used the little machines that measure, like the lie detector, your muscular tensions when certain things are brought up. They're working to try to get at complexes, the engrams, and to work them out so that the living would be more nearly to the ideal. He went up so far and so fast with his reading, both for the will and the personality swings, and for the brain radiation, that I said, well, I think we'll all have to go into Dianetics. This is a wonderful showing. And before his last signature came in, one day I had a letter from him, a very critical, very strange letter. I took the biometer and ran the signature, and something had happened. His reading was way down, even a little bit lower than it was when he started. It was a long time before I found out what had happened, but there had been trouble. He'd fallen from his high level with a great splash. And so we have a little bit of the danger to face of going too far too fast. In other words, the low self has to be brought along as fast as the middle self. The low self takes it slowly. It gets ideas by memorizing them. And we have to go over and over and over ideas, such as are contained in Huna, so that the low self can memorize them. It's a strange thing to say memorize the idea of being hurtless and remembering that no act that we do, if it is not hurtful to ourselves or to others, is a sin. It takes a great length of time and a great effort for a person brought up in the church who thinks it is a sin if you miss going to Mass to learn that the test of hurt must be applied. The subconscious also has many complexes. Some are good and help us, and some are bad. So we have to remember that the low self is a dull fellow in terms of middle self thinking, and that it must be taught over and over until it has reviewed its lesson, like it would its multiplication tables, and has absorbed the ideas behind those things. What I think would be good, if the Huna research work is to keep up and groups are to form, would be for each group to have its own biometer, and then for those in the group who have shown ability to use the pendulum, start in testing and working to learn to make a test for the brain radiation, for the will pattern, and for the personality pattern. If three people learn to make these tests, and if, say, on testing one person, they find that two people agree to a degree or so on the reading, then we could be rather certain that that was where they stood.